chickens in the trees, chicken in the pots, the mother walked the Petaloomies, out in Petaloomies. Oh, I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Tell me, how many eggs will a chicken lay? Marvin got me started, sold me my first hen. Now I got 4 and 20, and 24 more again. I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Oh, I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Tell me, how many eggs will a chicken lay? Chicken in the morning, it's chicken in the night. Weren't for chicken, Petaluma never would have reached its height. I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Oh, I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Tell me, how many eggs will a chicken lay?
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, smart talk about food, wine, farming, and many other things here in Sonoma County, the North Bay, and beyond. Thanks for tuning in, and thanks especially for tuning in live. I know a lot of people are doing other things tonight, but you're a very special audience, and we have very special guests and people I have been so excited about wanting to talk to about many things, and we'll see how many of them we get to tonight. We have Sandy Walheim. Did I say that right, Sandy?
Yes, you did.
Yay. The winemaker for the new Virginia Dare Winery, and then Elise Asimont.
Yes.
Viticulturist for Olive Coppola, right?
Yes.
Yes. Thank you so much. It's great to have you here.
Well, thank you so much on behalf of the Francis Ford Coppola Winery and family. It's such a thrill to be here with you. So, you know, mahalo nui loa. Yeah.
Thank you, too. Mahalo. Let's start with the story of Virginia Dare, because the way that it unfolded is so interesting.
Yes, the winery name was revealed this past September by Francis Coppola in a bit of a production.
I was there.
Yes, I remember, as he likes to do. And prior to that, there was a release of 4 different wines that were intro to the story of Virginia Dare. And on the East Coast, the story of Virginia Dare is very, very well known. Mm-hmm. But for most people, if I can say a few words about the history that anchors the whole story, then we can go into some of the other threads that are woven into that whole piece of fabric.
Absolutely. And the one thing I wanted to say just before you start is that for a time when this first started, there was that sign on the road that just said, white dough with an asterisk, look it up.
Look it up.
And it was, you know, who doesn't love a mystery and a ghost story?
Well, I do.
I do, too.
For one. But, you know, in this day and age, I think that was a different way to engage people in a wine brand, for sure, and leave it to Francis to, you know, do something kind of completely out of the playbook there. So the story of Virginia Dare it really resonates with the Lost Colony, which was a group of English people who sailed to the New World in 1587. And they sailed there as a charter for economic development, not to escape persecution or explore something, but because that they thought that there would be some economic development in the New World and that they would share in that economic reward. On this ship was John White and his family, his daughter Eleanor Dare and her husband Aeneas Dare. They were sort of sanctioned on this trip by Sir Walter Raleigh, a prominent figure who, and that was their connection to the crown in England. And they sail over there, and they're actually aiming for the Chesapeake Bay, Jamestown area, and they go ashore on Roanoke Island in what we know now as North Carolina, and in the Albemarle Sound, and they're sort of put off the ship by a somewhat angry Portuguese captain, and they're the colony or the colonists aren't allowed to go back on. But this site was not unknown to them, and in fact, there were some rudimentary buildings there from an expedition a couple of years before. And John White decides to make the best of it. They start setting up and to get going. They have connections with the local Croatan Indian tribe, and specifically with an individual named Manteo, whom John White and others in England had contact with, because Manteo made two trips to London and was sort of paraded around, but was very engaged by that new culture and drew the interest of many, many scientists and important people of the time in London. So it comes time for John White is going to return to England at the grace of the Portuguese captain to go back and get supplies, but not before his daughter gives birth to a baby. So if you could imagine in 1587 going on a trip across the Atlantic Ocean and you're pregnant and you arrive in a new world where there are very few amenities, probably zero amenities.
That's about right.
And she gives birth to a baby girl whom they name Virginia for the queen. And Virginia Dare is the first documented Anglican child born in North America. Mm-hmm. And she's baptized into the Anglican Church there in North Carolina. So we can assume from the story that there was a priest on the expedition as well, which seems like a good person to travel with.
Yeah, that's a good call.
Yeah.
It's who you want on your team. And something else that's interesting is that Manteo also was baptized as well. But you told me that during your research, Sandy, that he was baptized in Britain.
He was baptized within 5 days of Virginia Dare. But there are some pictures and graphic depictions of him that make you think that it happened at the same time, but like, apparently it didn't.
Like our label, the Manteo.
One.
It's a knockoff of the Episcopalian Church's relic of their icon of Manteo and Virginia Dare. Yes. Please continue. Sorry.
So John White, I'm sure quite reluctantly, leaves, promising to come back with supplies, and the colony is to, you know, make their way the best they can. And John White sails back to London, and at the time, the war with Spain has heated up. And this is the era when the Spanish Armada is sailing towards Great Britain, and they're trying to take over the control of the North Atlantic. And the Queen more or less requisitions every floatable device to defend the mother country. And he is unable to return for 3 years. He finally gets a boat and he goes back to the same place on Roanoke Island, and nobody's there.
Dun, dun, dun.
And they
everyone's gone.
They're gone. They
no can't, trace.
There's no people. There's a few traces, and there's a few clues. And one of the clues is Croatan carved in a tree.
That's not creepy at all.
But like nothing, no like arrow, we went this way, or a little note, or, I mean, this was 3 years later. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can imagine that like the place probably looked like a jungle after, if you didn't, you know, take care of your yard for 3 years, it'd look like a jungle.
Three winters, three hot summers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that group is forever called the Lost Colony, and no substantial live descendants have ever been found.
So no trace. That's the Lost Colony. Okay. Yeah.
About 100 years later, another Englishman, and you think about this, 100 years, they go back to look, and they are searching in the area, and he does some archaeological digging, and they do find artifacts that would have come from an English society. And there are rumors in the area that there are fair-skinned native peoples and blue-eyed native peoples. So possibly some of the members of the Lost Colony did survive, might have gone to live with and had children with native peoples, and there were some essentially mixed-race mm-hmm. people in that area. But it is one of the great historical mysteries of all time.
Yeah, interesting. Some of that I knew, some of it I didn't know. Now, what about the part where something happens to Virginia Dare and she's turned into a white doe or something?
Well, that's a part of the romantic historical fiction part. Sandy, do you want to take it?
Because
you tell this so much better than I do.
Well, what if Virginia Dare lived? Okay, so what if a little, I mean, against all odds, what if this little baby did manage to survive and grow up? And there is a myth that she did, because there's nothing to substantiate that she died. So maybe she did live, and perhaps she grew up to be a beautiful young woman, and perhaps she garnered the eye of young native people, and perhaps there was some rivalry and jealousy, and that's where the story of the white doe comes in.
Okay.
That in order to keep Virginia Dare from another suitor, a less kindly minded person with a magical arrow turned her into a white doe to keep her away. Shot her with a arrow and turned her into the white doe. And this was a kind of almost a mythical kind of, you know, little shades of unicorn going on there, you know, and managed to keep her away from the other suitor.
That is so interesting. I love this story. How did this story grow in the 21st century into, I think it's Francis Coppola's third winery?
Yes, it is Francis Ford Coppola's third winery, and the story grew because actually what year, in the early 1900s or late 1800s, Sally Southwell Cotton wrote the book The White Doe. Mm-hmm. And basically Sandy and I read it, and about half of it is an attribute to Sir Walter Raleigh. Mm-hmm. Basically, she was a big fan of that man.
Yes.
And then she goes into this beautiful romantic historical fiction piece.
Oh, okay.
And we believe that is the piece that mm-hmm. inspired Francis Ford Coppola to create this beautiful story. Mm-hmm. And name his third winery after this. But basically, in the end, it was two arrows, right? One arrow to turn her into the white doe, and one arrow, which was given to her true love, to turn her back.
To turn her back.
Into a fair maiden. Okay. But unfortunately, the timing was off. And so she was shot fatally by her lover, mm-hmm. or the man who truly loved her and she might have loved. There's a little bit of mystery over that. Mm-hmm. And where she had died, the white doe had died, her blood had fallen down, and the blood, when it touched the ground, sprung forth the mother vine, the grapevine.
A grapevine.
And it was a white grapevine. Mm-hmm. And that particular mother vine, they believe, based on looking at geological studies, still exists to this day in the Outer Banks on Roanoke mm-hmm. Island. And it's in the front yard of a wonderful family, the Smith family. And this is in front of you, a vine we brought to you as a gift that you can plant in your backyard. And it's a cutting from, we went out there last year and jumped on top of the vine and took cuttings. And we got a pass from the USDA. We had to get this the cuttings in from this person's front yard to a certified greenhouse within 36 hours, and we did. And Dr. Andy Walker. Because it's plant material. You can't transport plant material willy-nilly in the United States because of so many pests and diseases that we're afraid to spread. Okay. And I am on Sonoma County Radio, and I think every grower in Sonoma County would shoot me as I left your station if I did not tell them that I had done that. So it was all certified and clean. Mm-hmm. And we brought it to Dr. Andy Walker's lab at University of California at Davis. Mm-hmm. And in his mist chamber, he raised up these cuttings. We had 300 cuttings. 200 of them we deemed viable, and one of them made it. And from that one cutting, like the Thunderdome of Virginia deer, and one of those cuttings made it, and it is such a prolific species that one cutting, we were able to create enough cuttings off of that one cutting from last year to plant our new vineyard in front of Sandy's Winery. And it's very exciting. So she's a very special plant. I'm going to give it to you. She looks really, really thin and wiry.
Yes.
And don't let that fool you. She is Muscadinia rotundifolia. And Muscadinia rotundifolia is a different species. You're used to, Sonoma County folks are used to Vitis vinifera.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I should say that last week on Mouthful, mm-hmm. we had the president, and I believe it was vice president of the Atlantic Seaboard Wine nice. Association, and they had some vinifera, but they had a number of varietals we know nothing about here.
Yep. So this one's Muscadinia rotundifolia, and she is actually a she. She truly is a she. Her name is Scuppernong, and I have a little tag there for you. And so she can't bear fruit, so I'm going to need to give you, if you want her to bear fruit in your backyard, I need to give you a male species. Mr. Scuppernong's name is Carlos. I'm not kidding. Carlos is the most prolific pollinator for Scuppernong, and it really is named Carlos. Yeah. It's not Dr. Walker's way of making a joke here. So I'll give you some Carlos if you want some fruit.
That would be great.
And Scuppernong is a white varietal, and it's kind of like a Concord grape, if you've mm-hmm. ever worked with those. So it's kind of slip mm-hmm. skin. It's kind of like you squeeze the skin when they're ripe, and a gooey eyeball comes out.
Yeah.
And the gooey eyeball, you kind of crush down and get the juice. I love them because it's such a cool flavor. Sandy loves them. I don't know if Sandy's excited about making wine out of that. I don't blame her. I'll try to make jelly instead, but we'll do the best we can.
We'll give it a
yeah,
try.
But I'd love
jelly
to hear
and shrub.
Yeah, yes.
I would love to make shrub out of it.
Okay, shrub.
Yes,
that'd be great.
Shrub would be fabulous.
Sandy Walheim's Virginia Dare shrub.
Okay.
Dare shrub. I've been spending the last couple of years making shrub out of any fruit I can, and I'm getting kind of good at it.
At least
I like my shrubs.
I would feel like, Sandy, you would be the ultimate hipster if you did make a shrub out of your Scuppernong.
Well, perhaps you could give us a visual of what this mother vine looks like.
The mother vine is, all right, it is about the size of, okay, if anyone watching the Super Bowl today, a quarter of the size of that entire football field is the size of this one vine.
One
it is
vine?
Monstrous, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
So, yeah, 25 yards. Thank you. That's Cassius, my son. He's here. Say hi, Cash. And
Thanks for joining us.
he's 14, and he wanted to take a break from the Super Bowl and see what Mouthfuls is all about. So
I'm
that's awesome.
Very flattered. Thank you.
And so 25 yards, so it's a gigantic vine. And this vine as well could get that large. So when we do plant the vineyard in front of the winery along that 101 corridor north of Geyserville, mm-hmm. you will see us planting it. It's a very small piece, less than an acre, and we're going to have a pretty generous spacing on it mm-hmm. because these things are monsters.
That's mm-hmm. that's fascinating. I've never heard of a grapevine that's that big. You know, we're going to take a little musical break.
Plastic cowboy whispered from the wall, Nevada is just a day by car. I will not stray. No scope. got away, baby got away. She smeared her little mouth and she spit all of the hard words. Baby got away, baby got away. The night had gotten tangled in her hair. She chopped it off and buried it somewhere. I will not stray. No skull and crossbones in my way. Go girl, go girl. Go girl, go girl. Got away, baby got away. She set the house on fire and watched it from the back seat. Baby got away, baby got away. No flower in a vase can make her stay. Another passion flower takes her place. I will not stray. No skull
I'd wanted to do this evening was play the music by Virginia Dare, and but you know, Dan Hicks needs his time too. So if you want to pick up this show as a podcast, it should be up by Tuesday or Wednesday, and I'm going to drop in music by Virginia Dare, a band out of San Francisco. I heard them as early as 93 or 94, and they play this sort of old time, old American, really old American, not really Appalachian sounding, but haunting, with either a zither or an auto harp. And as soon as I heard about this, I was like, Virginia Dare, my gosh, this music is perfect. So I'll drop in a couple of songs and you can hear that. And they have to send you their CD. I think they have 3 CDs out.
Nice.
And you've got to hear them there in the tasting room. So, continuing the story of Virginia Dare. There was a winery, 100 years ago or something?
Yes. There was a brand called Virginia Dare, and it was very prevalent on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. And this is where Francis Coppola's connection comes in with Virginia Dare. Although I would think that the history of early settlers, colonists, it's much stronger on the East Coast.
Yes.
Across the board. So the W.L. Garrett Company began making wine in about 1830, I believe, around that time.
A couple hundred years ago.
They made a lot of wine prevalent on the East Coast, and they had a brand called Virginia Dare. And Virginia Dare, our label is very reminiscent of it. It's almost an exact copy, except mm-hmm. it has modern information on it. And Virginia Dare is depicted as a beautiful blonde, almost Victorian-looking gal who looks very sweet and young mm-hmm. and fresh.
It's a great label.
And and so we now own that label. And part of this is to bring this brand back to people. This is Francis's latest winery goal, and hence devoting the whole naming of the winery that, and now have the brand. And those other 4 wines that we were talking about, the White Doe, Manteo, 2 Arrowheads, and the Lost Colony, those were story introduction wines. And you said you liked that kind of serial reveal
it reminded me of a number of things that have, at time when things were happening, brought the whole country together. The most recent one that I can think of is back, you were not even born yet, I don't know if it was if in the late 50s or early 60s where suddenly you would hear, John, Marsha, John, Marsha. And this went on for quite a while, and it was brought to people's attention because it was talked about on Mad Men. But it was this whole thing, and the whole country was listening, and it was a coffee commercial. Mm-hmm. But then if you go back, say, to Charles Dickens and Thomas Hardy, when novels, great novels, like Thomas Hardy's mm-hmm. Tess of the D'Urbervilles, they were revealed in magazines in chapters.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so this, to me, captured that spirit. And I just love that.
Yeah, there's, it's a very different way to do it because most of the time when a customer comes into a winery, the staff there is ready with the story and ready to just kind of, here's our story and I'm going to tell you all about it. But as we were revealing it, it's like, here's the piece of the story that we know and can tell you right now, and we encourage you to come back and hear another part of the story. And so it's a story that ends with Virginia Dare, and it is based in history, and there's lots and lots of documented historical stuff about the lost colony. And even so, I think Jamestown is getting a bit of a revival in terms of archaeological excavation and things that they're learning there. So, which is really cool. We just stumbled onto a really fun little historyisfun.org. History buffs, I recommend you check this out.
And it's awesome.
It's totally awesome. Anna's adventures, and one of them is Eat Like a Powhatan.
Eat Like a Powhatan.
Historyisfun.org.
Historyisfun.org.
Anna's
and I think it can be. They're really intriguing stories. But getting back to the Garrett Winery and the Virginia Dare, so this was a brand that Francis saw when he lived in New York as a child, very prominent, you know, everything from your basic kind of like white wine and red wine. We have a Chardonnay and Pinot Noir in our collection. I don't think Pinot Noir was even something that back then in the 50s, you know, people would make.
So, you hope not. That would have been a tough call.
Yeah, that part's really fun. And, and our package has a very feminine look to it, I think. And I think that the wines that are in that kind of follow up that delicacy and that elegance that Pinot Noir and Chardonnay can lend to that.
I know with those first four wines, the ones that sort of teased to the name, I remember coming out for the tasting of the first one, which was, if I haven't read it, was Chenin Blanc and Viognier?
Correct.
Are those gone now?
Oh, no. No.
Okay, tell us about those.
Well, the white dough is a Chenin Viognier blend.
I have to say that is such a good wine. I really love that.
Thank you. Very tasty. I think that before people drank Chardonnay, they drank Chenin Blanc.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it tasted different back then. It was off dry.
That's true.
It was pretty off dry. Because I remember trying it and thinking, oh, I guess I don't like wine.
Ours is dry.
So, the Chenin Viognier, fresh and bright, very very kind of clean, delicate, kind of fits with the white dough, as being sort of simple and pure. Mantio, the second wine, depicts Mantio, the Indian, the Croatan Indian on the label with Virginia Dare, the baby in his arm, and she's holding a little tiny cluster of grapes. That is a big red wine built on big red varieties like Petit Verdot, Syrah, Petit Verdot, Syrah, Petit Syrah, a little bit of Cabernet and Cabernet Franc, and specifically selected for their kind of weightiness in the palate, not necessarily just because we thought they would go together well, and they did. And so that was the Mantio wine. The third wine turned out to be the one all the winemakers fell in love with, the Two Arrowheads, and that was one of our first wines from Paso Robles, and it was Viognier Roussan.
Well, I don't think I've had that. I think that's the one I missed. I haven't had that one yet.
We'll
change that.
Yeah.
We can fix that
we'll
for you.
We'll fill in that chapter for you. And I think that was also very happenstance that it came out that way on the because when we started this, the whole label generation thing was a bit up in the air. And so the one with the two varieties related to the white dough turned out to be the two arrowheads. And so it is it's a Vignier Roussanne blend, and it has a lot of the weight and mouth-filling richness of Chardonnay, but it's very low on the oak expression. Uh-huh. So it's a way to have that weight of Chardonnay without the oak element.
Which is a brilliant way to go.
And it's extremely aromatic. It is so pretty. Yes. It rocks those Viognier-like white flowers. It's just so nice.
Yeah. It's nice.
And one of the things we had last week was a Virginia Viognier.
Oh, wow.
And it was so remarkably different than California or West Coast Viognier. And I asked them why. What do they think? It's not as floral. Definitely has a big mouthfeel. And they said they think it's the soil. They think
wonderful.
The differences with the varietals are the soil. And it was so interesting.
Oh, I think terroir is always going to win out on you.
Yeah.
And I know many people might be cringing at me mentioning the T word.
No,
here,
it's
so
just
forgive
fine
me,
on mouthful.
But yeah, you got it. Great. It's a T word safe zone. But I do think that it's remarkable as well that Viognier sometimes can lend to a little bit of a bitterness, like a little bit of phenolic bitterness, and so can Roussanne. And the reason why I love how Sandy made the two arrowheads is that they're really, really beautiful. They're light on their feet. They're very aromatic. But somehow this woman just got a ton of mouthfeel into it. And so it's weightier without using oak and without using a lot of butter, you know, acetobutyl from, you know, malolactic. So it's super pretty. But I still love the white dough as well. So it's hard to, I consider two arrowheads my winter white and white dough my summer white.
There
you go.
Nice.
And we're missing one more wine.
Lost Colony, right?
The fourth wine is the Lost Colony, which kind of brings the whole story together and was the fourth wine, but it is a Malbec Syrah blend, and we just did a second vintage of that, and that second bottling is a Dry Creek appellation. So the first one actually was too, but fortunately we were able to get this one on the label in time. So it's nice to showcase some really fantastic Malbec from Dry Creek Valley as well as Syrah.
Now the labels on these wines are very distinctive. Are you using the same graphic artist for all of the, I mean, how is that part unfolding?
That's, all of our artwork is done in-house.
It is. Okay, that was my next question.
We have an art department.
Yes.
And
of course you do.
We are the Francis Ford Coppola Winery. We have an art department.
Yes, we have an art department.
We also have a visual department as well, so we're very proud of both. But our own artists worked on this, but thank you very much for noting that they're all very different from each other and very creative.
Yes.
Each
they tell
team,
a story. They tell a really interesting story.
Exactly.
I drink wine quite a bit. I recycle my bottles.
Good.
I can't get rid of those bottles.
They're beautiful.
They're lined up underneath the little bar in
Thank
the living
you.
Room. I just can't get rid of them.
We need to get her some two arrowheads to,
yeah, we
to
can,
finish
we
up
can
that
take care
collection
of that.
There. Yeah.
The Lost Colony label is a... we have permission to use an etching, a historical etching that depicts the return, John White's return to the Lost Colony. And they're standing around looking at the tree with Croatan carved into it. And there's a gentleman on there with a giant blunderbuss of a gun. It's like, you know, reaches to his shoulder. And
puffy pantaloons with puffy
and they're looking in a chest as though they're going to find a clue there. But if you do some history research, that etching will show up. One thing I do want to tell you about is John White. He was an illustrator and a map maker. And he, back in the day, when you didn't have cameras and things like that, you would take on your expedition an artist of some kind. And in addition to being the leader of this expedition, he also captured images of the native people, the Croatan Indians, and the and some of their life scenes and family scenes, and they were preserved and returned to England, and you can see them in the British Museum today. And this is how one way we know what these people look like, because if they weren't captured in an illustration, and their dress and their family life or their village life wasn't captured in some way, it's kind of it's gone forever because the people are gone mm-hmm. forever. So, and that's really cool that, you know, if you could go to the British Museum and say, I'd really like to see those John White things, and somebody, some expert would be thrilled that, oh my gosh, we have a customer today.
That's so good. Now, one thing I'm curious about, and as this whole thing unfolded, and I think it was like 6 months where it was just the white dough, look mm-hmm. it up, were you able to get any sense of what sort of reaction was happening with the public over that? Were people coming in and asking? Were you getting emails, phone calls, whatever?
We were getting all of the above.
Oh, people okay, great.
People were coming in, and then, you know, it takes a lot of bravery. That's where you look at the Francis Ford Coppola Winery, and you look at Francis Ford Coppola himself, and he's truly an artist.
Oh.
He doesn't play by those normal wine industry rules. We opened up a tasting room with one wine, and people were coming in tasting one wine, and okay, and then, well, what's this wine about? Well, look at up. And it was very engaging. It was, mm-hmm. you know, it was Francis's way of engaging the mm-hmm. wine consumer and asking them to think about it and dream, you know, and be creative. Mm-hmm. Then we get a second wine. Now we have a red and a white. Yay. We have the white Don Mantio, and people are still looking for more wines. It's much easier now. It relied very heavily on our hospitality team over at Virginia Dare to truly sell that story mm-hmm. and understand that story. And I loved sitting there and listening to them tell the story, because every time I kept learning more. Uh-huh. So it's really one of those things that's really beautiful. But again, you know, you can never look at our company and say, well, was it awkward for you? It's like, no, because it's always uncharted territory for us. Yeah. So
I have to say one thing about Francis. I remember when you hadn't yet unveiled the name of the second winery.
Francis Ford Coppola Winery.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I had gotten an invitation to a news conference. A press conference when the name was going to be revealed. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting at home, and it's raining, and it's warm in my house. I was thinking, oh, I don't want to go. You know, it's 45 minutes to Geyserville. And this little light went off in my head, and it said, Michelle, it's Francis Coppola. Get in the car. That's all you need to know. And I went, and it was one of the most dazzling things I have ever seen in my life.
Oh, that was him. He had designed his roadshow. Yes.
And I ended up sitting in the front. There were empty seats in the front. I was like, well, don't do that to anybody.
I think Sandy and I were quivering in the back, to be honest, holding on to each other.
Well, one of the things, Francis is, of every person I've ever met, he is, when he's on, he's the most inspiring person I have ever met. His energy and his connection and his love of what he's doing. And the thing that really brought all of that home to me was I was sitting there captivated, and he was saying all this, and now we're going to do this thing, and I'm listening, and he's drawing everyone in, and suddenly he said, jigsaw puzzle. And I probably jumped a little bit. Just a little tiny bit, just because I didn't expect that. And I'm not good at jigsaw, so I just jumped because it was unexpected. And he's looking for people that he's going to make go up there and do the jigsaw puzzle. But he's performing, and he's got this movie going and all this stuff going. And he looked at me, and he pointed at me, and he said, you jumped. Get up here.
Nice.
And it's like, how can somebody who is performing to the degree that he is performing notice something so tiny?
Because he's FFC.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I went up, and it was, you know, it was so much. It's one of I had so much fun at that press conference. Now, if presidents did press conferences like that, this would be a different country.
Well, it was a participatory
yes.
One. Huh.
But anyway, that's a little
magic show.
I just love telling that story because it was just such an incredible thing.
Well, it's a big year for us as well at the Francis Ford Coppola Winery. We're hitting, Sandy and I are hitting year 10. This is our 10-year anniversary.
Wow, congratulations.
Yeah, and we're very excited, and I think our winery have something planned. I'm on
a
the outskirts.
A 10-year anniversary?
Yeah.
I think maybe. Well, we love a party, so
we love a party.
And you know how to your Halloween party, I guess 3 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago? Mm-hmm. Best Halloween party ever.
Yes, Sandy really enjoys moving all those barrels around for people to host a bunch of people in the barrel room during harvest.
Yes.
That's a good time for her.
Yeah, I know which one.
It's her favorite. But
I want to get to you and talk about what you do as the viticulturist, but two more questions about Virginia Dare. I want you to talk a little bit more about what the tasting room experience is like, because the things that are displayed and also available for purchase are not what you typically find.
No, not at all. I mean, there's a very strong kind of Native people, Native American theme there. It is, if the other winery has elements from a Hollywood career, this tasting room couldn't be more far away from that. Lots of very interesting handmade jewelry,
baskets,
artifacts,
beautiful baskets,
things that represent a heritage in either all in the United States. Mm-hmm. We have some Pendleton blankets that. Those blankets have been woven in Pendleton, Oregon for well over 100 years. Mm-hmm. We have some cool stuff. Lodge cast iron for cookware. And
really?
I tried out the panini smusher tonight.
Oh, I haven't
on
seen
my,
that. Those are new. I have to
Cuban
get back up
pork
there.
Sandwiches, my Super Bowl dinner. So we have Lodge cast iron, another American company. Some beautiful rustic glassware. And just a very soft look in there. So and our staff is well versed in the story now, and can tell you if you come visit. Not just now, they have 6 wines to taste, inclusive of the Virginia Dare, Chardonnay, and Pinot Noir, and a little bit about what's starting to happen up there, because it's a bit of a construction zone right there around the tasting room now.
Oh, what's in the works?
Well, we have some very substantial remodeling, and we'll be putting in a restaurant as well.
You are?
Another restaurant, number 4.
No, wait. Number 4.
Cafe Zoetrope in San Francisco.
Right.
Rustic, Francis' favorites at the Francis Ford Coppola Winery. And then our seasonal
pool cafe
as well.
Oh, okay. I was counting Coppola Winery as one, but yes.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
4. So, tell us about that.
Well, that is projected to be this summer. That's a double cross fingers. Can only hope. So we'll see. There's always a lot of details involved.
Sure.
So hopefully they're hoping for a summer opening. Mm-hmm. Most of the construction will be inside the winery building itself, with the patio out there being extensively remodeled for outdoor dining.
Uh-huh. So the restaurant will be patio and?
Inside and patio dining.
Inside where
yes.
the... Where is it in relationship to the tasting room?
It will be to the south of the tasting room. There'll be a walk-through door in there. And
That's great news.
Level.
That's
fabulous. Very exciting. It's Geyserville can get to be a bit of the boonies. But, we have easy freeway access.
Absolutely.
So it's not that far away. And Geyserville itself is, building a nice visitor clientele, and they have a pretty lively evening restaurant business
Yeah, they do.
As well.
They do. And, it's a great place to visit. And we should tell people, if you know the old Geyser Peak Winery, that's the property for Virginia Dare.
Correct.
The old Geyser Peak. And,
yes.
Yeah. So
Canyon Road exit.
Canyon
right there,
Road.
Right
Canyon
off
Road.
Highway 101.
Yeah. And there's a huge sign on the building that says Virginia Dare.
So I saw it.
Miss that
I saw it when it was unveiled
with,
I think it was... people from the Today Show.
Right.
Yes,
were
the Today
filming.
Show
filming it.
Yes.
Had a curtain fall and
That was really
cool.
That was really, really fun. Well, let's move on to the job of a viticulturist and what you do.
Okay, so my job is to grow wine grapes. Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty broad description there. So more specifically, my team and I, there's a group, we're about 7 people in the viticulture department at the Francis Ford Coppola Winery. And we're responsible for all of the grapes that go into all of the programs for both the Francis Ford Coppola Winery and Virginia Dare Winery. Mm-hmm. And our responsibility is very simple and very clear. We need to grow exactly the right grapes for each program. So when we're growing grapes for Sandy, we have to grow to the very specific level of quality and style that she's trying to achieve, which means we need to get into Sandy's mind a little bit and learn what wines she's trying to make. So we work very closely with all of our winemakers at both facilities. And that's just basically really it, is take what Sandy or that particular winemaker needs, back it up into vineyard cultural practices, mm-hmm. and make it happen with all of the amazing wine grape growers that we work with throughout Sonoma County mm-hmm. and the state of California.
And so you're dealing both with what you're growing
right.
there on the estate vineyards, mm-hmm. as well as the different vineyards throughout both Sonoma County and the rest of the state.
Correct.
That you're buying grapes from. So do you travel a lot?
We do. Our entire team travels extensively. Mm-hmm. Everybody burns at least 30,000 miles on their vehicle a year. So it's a lot of churn and burn. Mm-hmm. But the wonderful thing is the majority of the state of California, it's north and central coasts and part of El Dorado County and northern San Joaquin County are our living classroom. And mm-hmm. it's a wonderful opportunity for us to work with over 200 growers throughout the state of California and mm-hmm. learn every day from them. And they learn from us by the specific level of style and quality we're trying to achieve. And together with our great wine grape growers throughout the state, we work together in tandem to make these, you know, that very specific style happen. Mm-hmm. There's many, many things you can do to tweak a vineyard during a specific growing season mm-hmm. to make that happen with regards to irrigation or when you pull leaves or how you prune. Uh-huh. And it's amazing at the end of the year, at the end of harvest, after it's all said and done, it takes us about 4 months to get through it, but we invite every single wine grape grower to sit down with us. If our winemaker can make it, they make it, and we go through all the data we've accrued throughout mm-hmm. the entire growing season, and then we show them all the data we have from in-house. We've got a lot of it. We love technology. We mm-hmm. love to embrace that. And we taste the wine that our winemakers made of their grapes, and then we taste the goal wine, the wine that we're trying mm-hmm. to put them into. Let's uh-huh. say it's the Virginia Dare Russian River Valley Pinot Noir. And we're sitting down with a Russian River grower, one of Sandy's favorites, I guess like a Dutton. And we're sitting down with the Dutton Ranches team mm-hmm. From out of Grayton, and we're working with them. And when they taste that wine, it's no longer this business relationship where we're buying their grapes and they're growing grapes for mm-hmm. us. It's now a partnership mm-hmm. to make Virginia Dare Russian River Valley Pinot mm-hmm. Noir. And it's eye-opening how that can happen. So that's my job.
I have a question about that. Mm-hmm. Because, Sandy, you said that the wine you feel are very feminine, and that is a word that sometimes people look at me askance when I use it, but I love very feminine Pinot Noir, and I think it's an accurate term. So I've always been curious if that quality is something that happens in the vineyard or when in the winery when it's being made. So what happens in the vineyard to move towards that more feminine rather than that darker, inkier, which I've always attributed to winemakers, and it sounds like I'm wrong.
Absolutely. It's honestly, I don't know if it's 50-50, but it's both, Michelle. Mm-hmm. It's really both. So when we're out there in the vineyard, you know, we're going to prune as early as we can. We're going to, try to hedge our bets to make sure that we're not getting wiped out by frost. Just trying to make sure we have crop available for our winemaker, mm-hmm. for Sandy to make Virginia Dare Pinot Noir. But then with regards to how we farm it, it's really trying to protect that feminine integrity of the fruit. Mm-hmm. I know I just sounded like a tampon commercial there, so I'm going to back that up, y'all, and fix that. So what we're talking about here is a lot of it is, you know, making sure that the fruit has enough exposure to sunlight and to air to make sure that we're keeping pest pressures at bay, but also allowing enough sunlight to the Pinot Noir, which is terribly picky, by the way, mm-hmm. and finicky, to develop enough phenolics, so tannin, which is the structure, and color, which is what you see when you drink, to make sure that that's developing well. Other things we like to do with Pinot Noir that's a great trick in Russian River Valley is we like to be as early as we can. Mm-hmm. So, you know, yeah. early bird gets the worm, early bird gets those feminine qualities. Mm-hmm. And the whole trick is pack as much flavor as you can while you're growing these grapes so you can pick them as early as you can. Mm-hmm. So when you're out there tasting with your winemaker and you're tasting the fruit, and let's say you're only at 23 and a half bricks, but if the winemaker is saying, if Sandy's saying, I love these flavors, this is beautiful. Sandy has a lot of cool terms that we've learned over the past decade together for Pinot Noir. What is it? It's not less filling, tastes great, but it's usually that's Sauvignon Blanc. She says less filling, tastes great. Pick it, least, and I'm like, okay, pick it. But you know, it's Sandy's looking for a very specific feminine style. She's looking for that raspberry tone. She's looking for that high cherry tone. She's not looking for that dark plum. She's not looking for that, you know, cassis. She wants that in her Syrah, in her cab. Mm-hmm. So when we get that, then the growers come in. They're all very capable, amazing people over there, and they pick it, and we bring it to her. But then, you know, the rest of the magic, it's we're only half the equation. We got to get the flavor profiles right in those grapes. But truly, Sandy and her team are the magicians in that cellar team to make that Pinot Noir happen. So it's truly a very much a team aspect, you know, on the Super Bowl Sunday. Teams are everything, right? So, yeah.
All right.
Interesting. You gave me a great answer.
Oh, you got it.
Really, really great
answer. Sorry about the ladies' serenity moment there.
Yeah. No, I thought that was just fine.
Okay.
Just fine. And, you know, some people cringe when you call Pinot Noir or any grape, when you assign, you know, a gender to a grape. Mm. And I just think that is such a great shortcut to describe certain qualities.
Well, I think the other thing, too, is that not to discount how difficult it is to grow big wines and masculine wines, and not to discount how hard it is, because Sandy's there and she's slugging as hard as she can to make some really big, powerful reds. You know, try Manteo, try Lost Colony, you'll be blown away. Try Archimedes, which is what she also makes. That's
a
big boy.
That is a well-dressed, well-mannered big boy.
He's a big boy.
Archimedes,
big guy.
Archimedes is, I mean, I don't drink a lot of, I taste big wines. I don't tend to drink them because.
But when I do have big wines, I have Archimedes.
Exactly.
I understand.
And it's a beautiful, I mean, it is a handsome wine.
Yeah, he's handsome. And Sandy knows how to make a big, handsome boy. But, you know, it's almost, in my opinion, it's almost harder to make those feminine,
I completely agree with you.
It's still balance, you know. I mean, there can be lots of intensity of fruit flavor, and we want to get all of that out in the fermenter, but then to balance it with the kind of oak that we're looking for and the oak flavor. I think one of the things about maybe a more feminine or elegant styled wine is the length that it has on the palate and how that continues to express flavor. Long and expressive and always kind of giving just a little bit more. And it has to have all these kind of fine attributes of texture and flavor to be able to have it in your mouth that long and to be continue to evolve a flavor element. So personally, I think Pinot Noir is really made in the vineyard. So what we're trying to do at least helps us match up that what our mental style with some good vineyards, and and we work together that way. Chardonnay can be a little bit more of a chameleon. And so to take a Chardonnay, look specifically for some flavor, and treat it in a style to kind of edge it over to a little more elegance and femininity, it can be a little bit harder. I think because Chardonnay is can be very robust, big, expressive wine, especially in Sonoma County.
The thing that I have found, and I've never ever really found anyone who can explain it or express it that well, is there is a quality in certain Pinot Noir that you get it in the aroma, it takes my breath away. It is.
Is it Russian River Valley or is it
often,
all Pinot Noirs?
No, it's Russian often Valley. Russian River Valley. Not exclusively. I found it in other things. It's the thing that made me fall in love with Pinot. It's the thing that made me write this very, not silly, but very over the top essay called Sex and a Single Grape. You know, you might want to read it sometime. It's very fun.
Yeah.
And I finally coined my own word for it. I call it penescence.
Oh, cool.
If it's the over-extracted inky Pinot Noirs do not have it, and it seems that when they're over-extracting, that's the thing they lose. And when it's there, and the best example, although I have to say, is it Votre Sante? I think it's Votre Sante has that.
Oh, thank you.
And I mean, I know it's the lowest priced of the Pinots.
Oh, I love that wine, though.
I love that wine.
I love Gary Farrell.
But Gary Farrell was, I cut my Pinot teeth on Gary Farrell's early wines before he even built the winery.
However did you survive, Michelle?
I'm not sure I did. You poor girl.
I'm not sure I did.
Because it ruined me. But those first ones, the 80s, when he still had that sort of abstract purple painting on his labels, they had that. And I started looking for it, and there was, I think it was either 92 or 94, B.R. Cohn Pinot Noir had it as well.
Okay.
And I found it here and there, found it in Votre Sante, and that is the thing that makes my heart and my palate sing. I love that. And then things got very over-extracted, and there was somebody, and I never found out who it was. I have my suspicions. But there was a winemaker in Napa who was saying his goal in life was the cabernization of Pinot Noir.
That's awful. That man should be taken out and
yes.
flogged.
Yes, and then it dropped off a little bit. You're
yeah.
starting to see the feminine side,
yeah.
feminine types come back. But that's sort of my mission when it comes to wine. That's
okay.
my holy grail.
I want to do a little, do we have time to do this? I want to do a little quiz with you. So
yes, like 3 minutes.
The pin essence that you have found. Okay, mm-hmm. I sound like I'm saying a bad word there, but
excuse
me.
Not.
Yeah, my son is in the room. Here we go. Have you ever detected this flavor profile in Anderson Valley Pinot Noirs?
Probably a couple.
A couple.
I'd have to think.
The less extracted ones?
It could be. I'm not sure if it's Golden Eye. There might have been one vintage of Golden Eye,
uh-huh.
but there have been a couple from Anderson Valley, and there have been two from Bien Nacido Vineyard.
Okay, got it. So I think, a lot of times, Sandy loves this one vineyard, and I love this vineyard, and Sandy always rolls her eyes, but I gotta call it the Morelli Ranch. So Dutton Ranches has this one ranch called Morelli.
Oh, yeah, I know it.
And its soil, Sandy's rolling her eyes right now, I can feel it, I'm not even looking at her. The soil is Goldridge Sandy Loam.
Okay, yes, Goldridge soil.
And I don't live on Goldridge Sandy Loam. I actually live technically on Sebastopol Sandy Loam, which is actually quite good, not as good as Goldridge. I'm sorry, y'all.
It's on the other side
it's
of
on
the tracks.
It's on the other side of the tracks. I'm on the other side of the tracks. But this soil is truly remarkable because it's extremely friable. And that's a $2 fancy tech term for you can break it up in your hands really easy.
Mm-hmm.
And I always have a term for it called, it's like ladies makeup. You know, like
yes.
when your mama
yeah.
used to have the powdered
right, that kind
you know,
of powder,
foundation.
Yeah. We've got 1 minute.
It's truly amazing. And I think that soils like that are extremely friable and extremely giving, require that Pinot Noir vine to basically work its ass off and to develop these beautiful flavors and that concentration. And if you have a good viticulturist who's willing to pick it early, and you have a good winemaker who doesn't have a gigantic ego and can taste those flavors and pick it and does that magical thing that they do like Sandy does, that thing that you do, I think that you preserve that. What you call pin essence and what I call pine forest floor meets crushed rose petals. And so that's
okay.
that flavor
okay.
quality. And I think it's something that Sandy and I are always looking for when we're trying to figure out when to pick.
And on that note, thank you so much, y'all. Come back.
Yes.
Promise you are great. It is Virginia Dare Winery, Canyon Road Exit, open 7 days a week, right?
Yes.
Okay, see you next week. It's Mouthful.
Thank you.
fast forward, trying to forget. Johnny Depp saves all his love for me. It's okay. 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 It's okay.